Okay, good afternoon. Good evening for whoever is on the phone, which may be in a different time zone. Welcome to the ICS version 1 for extended field testing stakeholders meeting. We're quite happy to have you here in Basel, and for some of you, we'll go through lots of things to set on the agenda, not much time, and we have lots of presentation also from you, which is quite important to go through for us. And we will start by giving you an update of where we are and a presentation, and then we follow them with presentation from different stakeholders. We have one from the CRO Forum, from Swiss Re, and the Swiss Actuarial Association, the IAEA, and then we'll follow with a question and a Q&A, but also more presentation if people are willing to do that in between, things which I'm not raised there. And we'll also deal with the ICP 15 and 16 public consultation. Then we'll open up the floor for a general session, and we'll discuss, again, presentation from stakeholders on general ICS topic, and we'll have, again, a presentation from the Geneva Association and the IIF. And we'll give you also at the same time, a clarification of what we can clarify at this particular point in time about what are the implications of the KEL agreement. And then we'll open up again for the floor. So without stopping that, I think I'll pass it to Mr. Windsor. Oh, before someone asks me, and before Danita kills me, just to remind you that the slides are available on the IIS website under Events Stakeholders Meeting. And at the same time, I would like to remind you that rules of the BIS, no pictures allowed in the room or in the building. The slides are already available. If you take any picture, you'll deal with Danita. It's not my problem. And also Jagger, yes.
Okay, so what we actually intend to do in this stakeholder meeting is to go through a simplified overview of the ICS. Now, I did a little bit of this sort of explanation in KL, just a little bit, and we got some good feedback about that. What we do understand is that it's very difficult for stakeholders who are not working for a volunteer in field testing to fully understand all the components of the ICS in enough depth. So we do understand that that's a difficult lift. It's difficult reading through just the consultation papers, let alone delving into the technical specifications and the template, etc. So one of our concerns here is that a number of stakeholder organisations make comments in the press about the ICS, and sometimes those statements can be incorrect simply through a lack of understanding of what's actually in the ICS and how it's been developed. So, I mean, one of the ones that I can think of that I've read in the press, and I won't attribute blame anywhere, but sometimes people talk about a one-size-fits-all approach, like the same treatment for motor vehicle insurance across different countries. Well, this is absolutely not the case, and we'll actually show that example so that you can see that we're definitely not taking a one-size-fits-all approach to that kind of business. We'll also give you a market risk example as well. So we're just attempting to debunk some myths about the ICS with this presentation. So for those on the phone, I'm talking about the ICS version 1.0 for extended field testing slide deck. I'm on slide 4, and I'm about to move on to slide 5. So you'll all have seen something like this before on slide 5 about what the objectives of the ICS are. Similar to the mission of the IIS itself, the ICS seeks to address both policyholder protection and financial stability issues. It is intended to be a foundation for higher loss absorbency for GSIs. It seeks to provide for comparable outcomes across jurisdictions in terms of IAIG capital requirements, promotion of sound risk management. You'll see a lot of these themes set out in the principles of the ICS, minimising inappropriate pro-cyclical behaviour, and I think perhaps most important is a common glossary for discussions with supervisors and other stakeholders, and that's really an aim of ComFrame, of which the ICS is a part. So the ultimate goal, and we're taking steps towards getting to the ultimate goal, is a single ICS with a common methodology that achieves comparable, and that is substantially the same outcomes across jurisdictions. So that's where we're aiming. So moving on to slide 6, key elements of the ICS. It's a group-wide consolidated standard for IAIGs, a minimum standard that IIS members should propose for adoption in their jurisdictions. A measure of capital adequacy for IIGs, and it's not a legal entity requirement. So it applies. We're aiming for the internationally active insurance groups. Of course, we are taking a stepped approach to implementation. We'll talk about that at the end of this this stakeholder meeting, as Paolo was saying about the KL agreement. But what we're talking about here is, you know, ultimately what we're aiming for in the ICS. Main components are valuation, qualifying capital resources, and a capital requirement. And the ICS ratio is qualifying capital resources over the capital requirement, as we'll see in a minute. And we're attempting to take into account all material and quantifiable risks. So the main risks there being insurance risks, market risks, credit risks, and operational risks. We're aiming for this to be more sensitive than the BCR that we'd already developed for GSIs. And ultimately, the idea is that the ICS will replace the BCR. Basis. So again, I'm aiming this presentation at the stakeholders who aren't volunteers. So volunteers, if you want to check your email, I won't be offended. Moving on to slide 7, and in terms of the key components of the ICS, we've got, as I mentioned before, valuation, capital resources, and the capital requirement. And often we're asked, why do you have valuation in there? Why don't you just rely on local accounting rules or local regulatory rules, etc.? Well, the valuation piece has a significant impact on both of those components of the ICS ratio, the ICS capital resources. As we'll see later, most of the ICS capital resources are actually derived from balance sheet values. So the valuation that's used on the balance sheet is absolutely critical. And similarly, the ICS capital requirement, you've got different ways of calculating that. So just to use an example, for some of the components, you've got a factor multiplied by item on the balance sheet. Like for credit risk, for instance, a factor multiplied by a value. So the value that you use is important in terms of determining what is the capital requirement. So that's why valuation is absolutely a key component of the ICS. It links into those parts of the ICS ratio. So we will now move on to talking about the valuation basis, and I'll hand over to Danita. What we'd like to do is actually go through all of this and give you just a quick comprehensive overview of the ICS, and then we'll take questions at the end.
We'll go through a couple of slides on valuation. We have two approaches to valuation that are currently part of field testing in ICS version 1.0, the market-adjusted valuation and the GAAP Plus. Both of these start from your GAAP numbers. The market-adjusted valuation specifies market value for investments and specifies how your insurance liabilities are calculated to arrive at a current estimate in a way that's consistent with the valuation of assets. So one of the key specifications is the approach to discounting, and the IIS provides yield curves to be used to create greater comparability across the volunteers and also to address volatility. For GAAP Plus, adjustments are made to insurance liabilities using existing audited systems to arrive at the current estimate. And the discounting is that which is applied in the relevant GAAP to the region where the liabilities reside. For GAAP Plus, there's an AOCI adjustment, and that's applicable for jurisdictions where insurance liabilities are measured on an asset book yield and fixed income investments backing those liabilities are reported at fair value. The final component of valuation that we consider in the ICS is the margin over the current estimate. Our aim is to eventually have a consistent and comparable margin over the current estimate that can be added to current estimates that are derived from either the market-adjusted valuation approach or the GAAP Plus approach. Okay. For the market-adjusted valuation approach, the focus is on comparability of valuation of assets and liabilities across IIGs, regardless of the jurisdiction in which any IIG's head office is located or the IIG's legal domicile. This should facilitate comparability of the exposure measures used for calculating the capital requirement as well as the amount of capital resources. To achieve this, the MAV requires that various IAIS prescribed adjustments are made to the most significant balance sheet items within jurisdictional GAAP accounting valuations, and that includes the requirement to use current estimates for insurance liabilities, the use of the IAIS prescribed yield curve, which is done on a per currency basis, in order to project and discount the insurance liability cash flows, and we require the use of fair value for financial instruments. The MAV approach should be transparent and verifiable to supervisors. In ICS version 1.0 for extended field testing, the approach taken for discounting is to prescribe the yield curves for 35 of the most traded currencies and provide a methodology for determining those yield curves to our volunteers in other markets that are not covered by the prescribed yield curves. The prescribed yield curves by currency were created by first determining a base yield curve, and that underlying that is either swap market data or government bond market data, depending on the currency. So a choice needs to be made between the use of government bonds or swaps. And then there's an adjustment applied to that base yield curve if swaps are used as opposed to government bonds. We adopted a couple of years ago the three-segment approach for the base yield curve. Segment one is considered the liquid segment, and that's based on market information. The underlying instrument is either the government bond or the swap, and the government bonds do not receive a credit risk adjustment, whereas the swaps receive a 10 basis point credit risk adjustment. Segment 2 is an extrapolation or gradation between segments 1 and 3. And segment 3 is where convergence occurs. That's the long-term forward rate. It currently begins at year 60 for all currencies. And the LTFR was determined using a macroeconomic approach based on information from the OECD. GAAP with adjustments, or as we call it, shorthanded GAAP Plus. It's an approach to valuation that was developed in response to concerns that departures from GAAP for valuation could pose operational and audit challenges. So So the Gap Plus approach is based to the extent possible on amounts, systems, processes, and rigorous controls that support reported gap amounts. Any adjustments should be transparent and verifiable to supervisors, internal auditors, and independent external auditors. The main driver of differences between MAV and Gap Plus, the results is the discounting. 2017 field testing included an approach to discounting, the high-quality asset approach, that was tested on both a MAV and a Gap Plus basis. And that was done in order to assist in highlighting any non-discounting related differences in insurance liability valuation between the two approaches, the market-adjusted approach and the gap with adjustments approach. Gap Plus specific risk charges have been developed for interest rate risk and credit risk. All other risks use the same risk charges between MAV and Gap Plus. As a result of recent accounting rule changes under IFRS and anticipated changes under US GAAP that will significantly impact valuations of invested assets and insurance contracts, it will be necessary to reevaluate the current design of Gap Plus for jurisdictions that report under IFRS or US GAAP. So we're looking to modify what is field tested for Gap Plus as part of 2018 field testing, bit of a forward-looking exercise that attempts to replicate where the FASB or the IFRS will be going in the future. So it's unlikely that the current Gap Plus approach will be field tested next year because we know that there are going to be many changes in the different gaps, so it doesn't make sense to test something that will be obsolete in the future. Okay. On the margin over the current estimate, over a few years we've been developing the consistent and comparable MOCI with two constructs currently part of field testing, the cost of capital approach and the prudence approach. The cost of capital is based on an arm's length transfer of liabilities at market value and is implemented as a measure of cost of capital. The prudence approach is a percentile of insurance liabilities and the underlying non-life, what the purpose of the prudence approach is to avoid the recognition of future profits. Okay, so as part of a prudential framework, the purpose of the risk-adjusted valuation of insurance liabilities is to bring the value of insurance liabilities, which would be the current estimate plus the margin over current estimate, to an amount that's sufficient to allow the transfer of insurance obligations to a willing third party or allow the own fulfillment of these insurance obligations within the originating insurer. The cost of capital MOCI, or the C-MOCI, is expressed as a sum of the discounted current and future capital requirements multiplied by a cost of capital parameter. We've adopted several simplifications to avoid unnecessary complexity within the calculation of the cost of capital MOCI. One of the simplifications that we use is that most market and credit risks have been excluded from the calculation as they could be hedged, and the discount rate that's used for the determination of the cost of capital MOCI is the risk-free rate. For the cost of capital MOCI, there were two options being considered as part of ICS version 1.0, a fixed cost of capital set at 5%. That was tested the previous year as well, and new in the 2017 field testing in ICS version 1 was the adjusted cost of capital that's linked to the level of the risk-free interest rate. The cost of capital was defined as 3% plus the 10-year risk-free rate, and it's subject to an absolute cap of 10% and an absolute floor of 3%. On the prudence MOCI, it's intended to be a simple and comparable way to calculate the margin over the current estimate to ensure policyholder protection. The P-MOCI construction for life obligations measures the uncertainty of cash flows associated with life insurance obligations using a confidence interval approach and a normal approximation. For non-life obligations, the P-MOCI approach is based on avoiding the recognition of future profits. Now, you would have seen in ICS version 1.0 for extended field testing that there were multiple ways in which the margin over the current estimate could interact with the capital requirement or capital resources. I think we had five options included. The rationale and motivations for these different interactions are often related to the perception of the level of double counting that exists between the margin over the current estimate and the capital requirement. So for ICS version 1.0 for extended field testing, we're looking to explore and assess these different interactions to determine which way the MOCHI should move going forward for the ICS.
Okay, so I'm going to now take you through the ICS capital requirements, so we'll move through to slide 17. For ICS version 1.0, the ICS capital requirement is calculated on a standard method specified by the IAIS. The aim of the capital requirement is to reflect actual risk rather than proxies for risk. This means that the ICS capital requirement is flexible depending on the nature of the risks inherent in the product sold by the IIG and the investments held to support those liabilities. So this is what we refer to as risk sensitivity and makes the ICS risk based. So it's important to remember that the full name of the ICS is the Global Risk-Based Insurance Capital Standard. And this is where sometimes when we hear from stakeholders, oh, it's a one-size-fits-all type of approach. Well, it does actually respond to the different kinds of risks held by different kinds of IIGs around the world. However, there's always a trade-off in developing a standard method, and that trade-off is between comparability and risk sensitivity. So, of course, the standard method can't be as tailored as an internal model would be, but it is still risk sensitive to a significant degree. So, moving on to slide 18. So overall, there's three ways in which we calculate components of the ICS capital requirement, which we call risk charges, and we'll talk about how those risk charges are then aggregated into the overall capital requirement. First one is, and this is only used for one type of risk, it's model-based, so that's for natural catastrophe. It's pretty much the only way you can actually measure that kind of risk, so that's why we use a model-based approach there. We use factors, so that's where you have an exposure measure, something like a current estimate, multiplied by a percentage. So that's what a factor-based approach is, and many would be familiar with those sorts of approaches from capital requirements around the world. For some risks, that's still the best way to measure those risks. And then we have the stress-based approach, where we define a stress such as a change in mortality assumption, for instance. So this is the most used methodology through the ICS. It gives a direct view of the impact of a risk on the balance sheet of the IIG. So when you look at it formulaically, I mean, essentially you get a risk charge by looking at the change in the net asset value of the balance sheet after the application of the stress. And then some of that can then be reduced by taking into account management actions such as how much of that would be transferred to policyholders through changes in bonuses, for instance. So that is generally how the stress-based approach works. It is you apply a stress, and it's the change in the net asset value of the IIG based on that stress. that that gives you then the risk charge.
And when you look at why did you select for certain things, the factor based or certain things, the stress based,
the strength quite not it.
The selection is mainly based on the fact that actually one impact, a factor base is typically selected when it impacts only one part of the balance sheet, whereas when you look at the stress base, effectively any particular event will affect both assets and liabilities. So you, for an insurance, you've been screaming for ages when you deal with, for example, when you came out with a BCR that you thought was an appropriate approach because, you know, typically in insurance you need to look at assets and liabilities in conjunction, and that's what a stress-based approach tries to do.
Thanks, Paolo. So slide 19 sets out where we actually use the different approaches. So we use the stress-based approaches in the life risks. We use factor-based for the non-life or P&C risks. As I said, for catastrophe, we use a model. For the market risks, we use a stress-based approach. And for asset concentration, credit risk, and operational risk, we use a factor-based approach. So a little bit of a hybrid approach, actually, in credit risk, because we say it's a factor-based stress. So while we apply a factor to the asset values, what we do also take into account is if that credit stress did happen, to what extent could the IIG pass that the losses on to policyholders through the management action. So that's one case where it's a factor-based calculation, but we also allow the impact on bonuses, et cetera, to be taken into account. So that's the overview of how the risk charges are actually calculated, and it takes into account the actual characteristics of the products and the investments held by the IIGs. So then we move on to slide 20, and we can see there that there's a multi-step approach to aggregating all of those risk charges. So actually we need to move from right to left in this diagram. So you start with individual risks that are, so if you look at, probably it's actually better to look at the next slide to explain this, so slide 21. So for instance, market risk is one overall risk, but within that there's interest rate risk, equity risk, real estate risk, currency risk, and asset concentration risk. So there's a correlation matrix that is used to aggregate all of those individual market risks into an overall market risk, and then all of the risks like market risk, life risks, non-life risks, etc., are combined in an overall correlation matrix to give you the overall aggregation of risk charges, which then gives you the ICS capital requirements. So clearly, you know, the more diverse the IIG's business, the more benefit they gain from having this approach to aggregating using the correlation matrices. So, some examples. How does this work? So let's lift the bonnet or the hood, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, and have a look at how some of these calculations are actually done. So I'll give you an example of a factor-based one and a stress-based one. So for non-life, we start with jurisdictional lines of business, as defined in the regulatory framework of the home jurisdiction in which the business is written. So this is very important. So if you've got a US-based group writing European business, we start with the European definitions of lines of business. And similarly, if we have a European-based group writing US business, we start with the US definitions of lines of business. For each of these lines of business, we've determined a factor at a 99.5% VAR over 1 year time horizon level. And that factor, well, we actually come up with factors for the claims for reserve and also for premium risk. So we have a factor that is applied to the greater of the net earned premium and net premium to be earned over the next year. So that's for the premium risk charge. And then we have a factor applied to the net current estimate, and that's for the claims reserve risk. So the next slide actually shows that we do take into account different risks in different markets. So this is actually the full list of all the different kinds of calibrations that we have for motor vehicle type business. So there are different aggregations of risks in different markets. Most markets have two lines of business, one about the physical sort of damage to the vehicle or other vehicles and infrastructure or whatever, and another one for liability. Generally that's how we see it set up, but it's not always that way. And you'll see that we've got different premium and reserve factors depending on the data that we have seen, and they're all calibrated at the 99.5% VAR level, but this reflects the volatility in the data that we've actually seen. So that's how we actually do differentiate for different markets. So the differences do reflect the differences in the risks in those markets. Now I'll give you a stress-based example. So this is equity risk. Essentially, what equity risk is trying to do is pick up all direct and indirect impacts on the financial situation of the volunteer group by applying a stress on the value of the equities, and the stress is to both the level of equity prices and also the volatility of those market prices. So we apply one scenario, and that scenario is prices down and volatility up. So both things happening simultaneously, and we have different calibrations for different kinds of equity exposures. So if you look at shares in developed markets, we apply a 35% shock to the values of those equities. Compare that to emerging markets. Data tells us that emerging market shares have higher volatility. Therefore, we apply a prices down scenario of 48%. So, and then for hybrids, we apply different shocks on the prices depending on their rating. So then you'll see if you get down to B or below, it's the same as the shock on the listed shares. So this is then applied, obviously the assets decline, and then we see how that can then be passed through to the liability. So it's a shock on the overall balance sheet. We also do the shock to volatility. So we look at the increase in implied volatilities, and depending on the maturity, you've got different levels of shocks to those implied volatility. So starting with from a fairly large shock for 1 month out to a much lower shock, 180 months plus. So that is how, in a very short explanation, how the capital requirements, how the each of the individual risk charges are calculated and how they're aggregated together. And now I'll pass over to Danita for capital resources.
We won't go into too many details on capital resources, but what we want to do is give kind of a high-level picture of how qualifying capital resources are determined within the ICS. We're on slide 27 right now. What we've seen in the last 3 years of field testing is that approximately 85% of total qualifying capital resources come from balance sheet items such as retained earnings, AOCI, regulatory reserves. Whereas the issued financial instruments, including common shares, account for only about 15% of qualifying capital resources. So if we look at a simplified view of qualifying capital resources in the ICS, we calculate total ICS capital resources as the sum of Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 1 includes the balance sheet equity items, like retained earnings, AOCI, as we mentioned, and instruments like common ordinary shares, and perpetual non-cumulative preferred shares. We take away instruments that wouldn't meet the Tier 1 criteria. Within the technical specifications for the ICS, there's qualifying criteria against which all of the financial instruments are assessed to determine if they would be Tier 1, Tier 2, or non-qualifying. And then certain assets that would have little prudential value, such as goodwill, deferred tax assets, and so on, are deducted from Tier 1. Tier 2 would include qualifying debt instruments, so debt on your balance sheet. Right now, it's mainly subordinated debt that meets the qualifying criteria for Tier 2. There's some add-backs of some of the deductions from Tier 1 that get recognition in Tier 2, such as realizable portions of the DTA, encumbered assets. That was a change in 2017 field testing that encumbered assets deducted from Tier 1 would actually be added into Tier 2 rather than having them not feature anywhere in the ICS qualifying capital resources. Slide 28 gives a breakdown of how the qualifying capital resources are accumulated. We've got Tier 1 and Tier 2. So Tier 1 items are expected to absorb losses in both going concern and in winding up, whereas Tier 2 capital would absorb losses only in winding up. In Tier 1, you've got unlimited Tier 1, which is the common and ordinary shares mainly, and Tier 1 Limited, a bit different criteria for Tier 1 Limited, and very few instruments issued would meet that criteria right now. It's generally a preference shares that are perpetual as well as non-cumulative. For the Tier 2 capital, you've got paid-up Tier 2, which are your paid-up Tier 2 debt instruments that meet the qualifying criteria, and there is a provision for some recognition of non-paid-up capital in Tier 2. It's limited to 10% of the ICS capital requirement at this time. The criteria for the financial instruments are based on five themes, I would say. We look at loss-absorbing capacity. We look at the level of subordination of the instrument. We consider its availability to absorb losses. We consider the permanence of the instrument and the absence of encumbrances and mandatory servicing charges. So all of the criteria that have been developed for Tier 1 Unlimited, Tier 1 Limited, and Tier 2 Paid Up trigger off of those qualifying features in order to assess whether the instrument should be Tier 1 or Tier 2. So before we call up our first round of stakeholders to present, if you have any questions on the high-level ICS slides that we've just been over, please let us know.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have now the opportunity to ask questions by dialing star 14 on your telephone keypad. At your turn, you will hear a short announcement saying unmuted on your line.
I have a question on slide 15. So under the cost of capital MOCI, you've got it allows own fulfillment of insurance obligations, and you don't have that under prudence MOCI. Like, I would think that the prudence MOCI would also allow own fulfillment of insurance obligations. It would be more consistent with that. So would that be consistent with what you think, or is there something else?
Yeah, I think it probably should be across under prudence MOCI, but I think perhaps both are true. I mean, it's for cost of capital. I mean, the main concept there is transfer, but it puts the value of the liabilities on a similar basis to the asset side as well. So for the purposes of holding those liabilities, it's also an important concept for the consistent valuation of assets and liabilities. So, yeah. Other questions? Steve?
No questions from the phone.
Thank you, Peter. Steve Brody from PCI. I just wanted to go back to the non-life example and the premium and reserve factors. Are those all calibrated at a 99.5 R? And that is before you even look at a MOCI, correct? I guess my question on top of that is how does addition of a MOCI then not result in a capital requirement that's greater than a 99.5 R, or does that depend on what you do with the MOCI, whether it's in liabilities or capital or whatever?
I think you have different ways of dealing with that, and depends on the purpose which the MOCI is serving. Because if the MOCI is part of liabilities, why would you say there is double counting? And you have to say, just to make things a bit simpler, liabilities are there to cover your expected losses over the time horizon of your liabilities. Capital is there to cover the unexpected loss over 1 year time horizon. So if, and only if, there is double counting, that would be related to 1 year, not to the lifetime of the liabilities. So I think we need to step back a bit to the building blocks of that, and what the purpose of liabilities and what the purpose of capital doing and the purpose of MOCI. At the same time, we are dealing, what we need to remember is that the ICS is not a going concern. The ICS is a going concern regime. This is quite important as well. I mean, lots of the discrepancy, lots of the difficulty we face is actually when people coming from a going concern type of regime, they say, oh, but it's doing something different. No, it's a going concern regime. Yeah.
Hi there, Michael Bootman, AXA. Can you go to slide number 6? I think I have a question about the adoption process. So the ICS is a minimum standard. So what exactly does the adoption mean? And I ask it specifically, for example, in relation to Solvency II. So if the Solvency II is more or less in line with the ICS, would the Solvency II standard be an adoption, a local implementation of the ICS? Or if that's not the case, does the ICS have to be adopted as a standalone standard and therefore it needs to be approved by European Commission, Parliament and Council and then transposed into national law? Can you clarify that? And also the relation to Comframe. So can the ICS be adopted standalone, or can it only be adopted as part of the full Comframe package?
Okay, we'll get to the details with respect to that later on. What is quite important to say and to remind people is that the IIS is a standard setter, is not a regulator. We set the standard. We don't implement the standard. So by setting the standards, it's up to jurisdiction to look at their own standards and decide and look at the IIS standard and see what steps they need to take to implement the IIS standard, taking into account the local specificities. So if you expect us to say this is compliant, this is not compliant, and this is a job that needs to be done by jurisdictions, not by us. I thought you were meant to be silent today.
No, just a question.
That's what you said before.
No, mate. In this case, could it be mandatory if you say that it's a standard? How could you say that it will be mandatory?
What do you mean? Can you believe that?
I have read somewhere in a communique that...
Can we deal with this type of issue when we deal with the second part of the thing?
Okay,
so here we're talking about the technical issues related to the ICS.
Yeah.
And we kept them separate because we want to have... Because I'm pretty sure that this is not going to be the only type of discussion, but this is like to take a long time and distract from the technical issues. So we're not going to forget about your question. We're going to deal with that.
Hello, good afternoon. So if there aren't any more questions, we will proceed to the stakeholder presentation on the technical issues. And first up are our colleagues from the CRO Forum, who are here today to speak about the use of internal models in ICS version 2.0.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the opportunity to present our thoughts and also the paper on the use of internal models in the context of the international capital standard, the risk-based international capital standards. Let me first refer to the agreement that you announced beginning of November, that now internal models have their place in the next years in the monitoring phase of the ICS, that we absolutely appreciate and also see as a very good step in the right direction. We are here today, but also this is what the paper is concerned with, of course, to make the case that we want to use internal model also in the ICS framework as a leading metric to determine the capital requirements for insurance groups like the ones we are representing. So who we are and who do we represent? As a CRO forum, we are 23 insurance groups, mainly with their headquarters in Europe. Even so, we have AIG also including in the CRO forum. This is just an indication that we are open, but it's more a logistical topic because we meet very frequently. We also have a very close interaction on topics, on working groups, and that's also why it turned out to be simply a positive to have the participating parties well within reach. And so this is a current mix of companies that we are representing. Perhaps one thing to remember is the CRO Forum was founded and established in 2004, and what brought us together? Well, after the bursting of the dot-com bubble and share pricing going down in 2002 and 2003 and some market turmoils and some unpleasant experience in the insurance industry, especially in Europe, risk management was, of course, top of the agenda. And what was the main purpose in the beginning when the CRO Forum was founded was to discuss about internal models, to also develop internal models and also to share the views that we have on internal models, and especially the link into economic steering and also steering of an insurance group where we have an holistic view on liabilities but also on assets, because that was exactly what turned out to be missing in 2001-2002 in these experiences and in these times. And so that was where the focus was, and so we are very happy to be loud again on internal models now in the context of the ICS. And also looking into our aims, best practice and risk management, very good to see also that this is completely in line with what the ICS version 2.0 is targeting, but also I think alignment of regulatory requirements with best practice and risk management. This is exactly why we are here. Perhaps quick introduction of who we are. So I'm Bernhard Kaufmann, I'm the Chief Risk Officer of Munich Re, currently chairing the CRO Forum, and with me are Gregor from AXA. He's head of the Enterprise Risk Management Division at AXA, and Fabrice Bossard, he's the CRO of AIG in Europe. And so also I think we are representing exactly the international companies that ICS, of course, is targeting. Now, use of internal models in ICS, and the paper we wrote in July or published in July was before the agreements that was reached in Kuala Lumpur beginning of November, but still the main point we wanted to address is let's in a risk-based capital regime give the opportunity to use internal models as a leading metrics for those companies who can qualify for this, also who of course have to go through some sort of approval, but the points that we want to discuss in a little bit more detail about the advantages of internal models in this context are from our perspective so overwhelming that we are sure about that this is a very substantial contribution also to a better risk-based capital regime also in an international context. Now, on a very high level, what are the points or the advantages of using internal models in such a framework? I think one of the major points always to remember is linking risk measurement and the risk models to steering, that this is really making a company making better decisions at the end of the day. So the impulses you get out of a risk-based capital assessment and also the translation into steering, that is the essential part. Having this somehow not linked together is causing problems. And now with us as international insurance groups, to have a metric and to have a good representation and a fair representation of our risk profile, that of course is something that only can be done by internal models, to really being able to get all the details of our business models somehow risk adequately captured, and then also being able to use this information and the results in our steering processes. That is what we currently get out of this, and of course also want to make sure that this is in an international capital regime also the case. What else is important. Incentivization of management to really steer the business in a risk-adequate way and also improve product development or any kind of pricing processes, that was exactly what I was mentioning, to use the information in steering, which also simply the use of the internal model. The regulatory perspective, also there we see positive effects, like also having transparency, having also one metric that make it possible to really dig into where the risks are, where the companies and their specifics are. Also this, I hope, is a good argument also for the regulators and the supervisors to support the use of internal models. Now, not allowing the use of internal models, again, it's more of course the opposite of what I just talked about. Perhaps two issues to also keep in mind, especially if it comes to reinsurance business, any kind of factor-based approach will always be not adequate. If you think about cyclone risks in Australia, if you have a quota share agreement or excess of a loss agreement or treaty with the same premium and you would use some sort of factor-based approach, this would completely be or making no sense in such a risk assessment or for such a reinsurance contract. We as representatives of international groups, we will find or can find many examples where this simply is not adequate. And so mainly also, again, being concerned about the risk adequacy of this regime is the one to mention. Also, of course, simply in identifying new risks, also being able to manage new risks in a regime where really you also have the link from modeling to really the steering is essential from our perspective. Take cyber risk as a news example. Any kind of standard formula treatment of cyber risk, I think, would in the end or in the beginning be not adequate. I think we have good models, but also processes in place really linking this into real action and making the difference. That's as an introduction, and now I'm very happy to hand over to Grégoire.
Thanks, Bernard. Good afternoon to all. starting from the general introduction from Bernard, I would like just to lead you through a bit more detailed grounds and reasons why we believe internal models are to the benefit of both the companies that develop and use them, and also to the benefit of the supervisors. Starting with the perspective from the industry, I think the basic question is, what does the use of internal model bring us in addition to the standard approach? At a minimum, it brings us the ability to use some tools in a way which ensures a full consistency between the way we develop those tools, the way we use them for internal steering of the business, internal risk management, and the formal and true capital requirements that we have to hold according to the to the regulation. If I can give some examples of those tools, the first one, maybe the one that is most directly linked to the capital measurements derived from the internal model is the return on capital. Of course, we want to steer our businesses using return on capital metrics. And it's clearly from the perspective of us as group that use internal models, a huge incentive to truly steer our businesses using this kind of metrics, that the return of capital that we use internally is exactly aligned with our analysis on, of the risk on the one hand, and the capital requirements that we have from the regulation on the other hand. A bit in a similar way, we all, I'm sure, use combined ratios, combined operational ratios to steer our P&C businesses, especially. We know all the advantages of these kind of